Among the towns of Jutland, Viborg justly holds a high place. It is the seat of a bishopric. It has a handsome but almost entirely new cathedral, a charming garden, a lake of great beauty, and many storks nesting above the chimneys. There are good hotels in Viborg. Preisler's and the Phoenix are all that can be desired. But my cousin, and it's about my cousin that I'm going to tell you, went to the Golden Lion the first time that he visited Viborg. He has not been there since. And what I'm going to tell you will perhaps explain why. The Golden Lion is one of the very few houses in the town that were not destroyed in the Great Fire of 1726, which practically demolished the cathedral and so much else that was old and interesting. It's a great red brick house. Well, that is, the front is of brick, but the courtyard into which the omnibus drives is of black and white wood and plaster. It was late afternoon when my cousin walked up to the door, and the setting sun lit up the imposing facade of the house. He was delighted with the old-fashioned aspect of the place and promised himself a thoroughly satisfactory stay in an inn so typical of old Jutland. It was not business in the ordinary sense of the word that brought Mr. Anderson to Viborg. He was engaged upon some researches into the church history of Denmark, and it had come to his knowledge that in the archive office of Viborg there were papers saved from the fire relating to the last days of Roman Catholicism in the country. He proposed, therefore, to spend a considerable time, perhaps as much as a fortnight or 3 weeks, in examining and copying these. And he hoped that the Golden Lion would be able to give him a room of sufficient size to serve alike as a bedroom and a study. His wishes were explained to the landlord, who suggested that perhaps it might be best for the gentleman to look at some of the larger rooms and pick one for himself. It seemed a good idea, and on the first floor there was a choice of two or three rooms which would, so far as size went, suit admirably. The landlord was strongly in favour of number 17, but Mr. Anderson pointed out that its windows commanded only the blank wall of the next house, and that it would be very dark in the afternoon. Either number 12 or number 14 would be better, for both of them looked on the street, and the bright evening light and the pretty view would more than compensate him for the additional amount of noise. Eventually, number 12 was selected. Like its neighbours, it had three windows, all on one side of the room. It was fairly high and unusually long. Supper time was approaching, but when Anderson descended the staircase, there was still a few minutes before the bell rang. He devoted them to examining the list of his fellow lodgers. As is usual in Denmark, their names were displayed on a large blackboard, the numbers of the rooms being painted in at the beginning of each line. The list was not exciting. The only point which suggested any food for thought was the absence of any number 13. And even this was a thing which Anderson had already noticed half a dozen times in his experience of Danish hotels. He could not help wondering whether the objection to that particular number, common as it is, was so widespread as to make it difficult to let a room so ticketed. And he resolved to ask the landlord. He returned to his room after dinner, and towards 11 o'clock resolved to go to bed. But with him, as with a good many other people, an almost necessary preliminary to sleep was the reading of a few pages of print, and he now remembered that the book he'd been reading in the train was in the pocket of his greatcoat, then hanging on a peg outside the dining room. To run down and secure it was the work of a moment, and as the passages were by no means dark, it was not difficult for him to find his way back to his own door. So at least he thought. But when he arrived there and turned the handle, the door entirely refused to open, and he caught the sound of a hasty movement towards it from within. Well, he tried the wrong door, of course. Now, was his own room to the right or to the left? He glanced at the number. It was 13. Well, his room would be on the left, and so it was. And not before he'd been in bed for some minutes, had read his wonted three or four pages, blown out his light, and turned over to go to sleep, did it occur to him that, whereas on the blackboard there'd been no number 13, there was undoubtedly a room numbered 13 in the hotel. On the day after his arrival, Anderson attacked the archive office of Viborg. He was, as one might expect in Denmark, received with kindness, and access to all that he wished to see was made as easy for him as possible. The documents laid before him were far more numerous and interesting than he had anticipated. Besides official papers, there was a large bundle of correspondence relating to Bishop Jürgen Fruss, the last Roman Catholic who held the see. And in these, there cropped up many amusing and what are called intimate details of private life and individual character. There was much talk of a house owned by the bishop, but not inhabited by him, in the town. Its tenant was apparently somewhat of a scandal and a stumbling block to the reforming party. He was a disgrace, they wrote, to the city. He practiced secret and wicked arts and had sold his soul to the enemy. On leaving the office, Mr. Anderson was accompanied by the old gentleman who presided over it, and as they walked, the conversation very naturally turned to the papers of which I've just been speaking. Herr Scavenius, the archivist of Viborg, though very well informed as to the general run of the documents under his charge, was not a specialist in those of the Reformation period. He was much interested in what Anderson had to tell him about them. "This house of the Bishop Fruss," he said, "is a great puzzle to me where it can have stood, although I've studied carefully the topography of old Viborg. Never mind, perhaps I shall some day succeed to find him." So Anderson went back to the Golden Lion, his supper, his game of patience, and his bed. On the way to his room, it occurred to him that he'd forgotten to talk to the landlord about the omission of number 13 from the hotel board, and also that he might as well make sure that number 13 did actually exist before he made any reference to the matter. The decision was not difficult to arrive at. There was the door, with its number as plain as could be, and work of some kind was evidently going on inside it, for as he neared the door, he could hear footsteps and voices, or a voice, within. He went on to his own room, and he was surprised to find how much smaller it seemed now than it had when he selected it. It was a slight disappointment, but only slight. If he found it really not large enough, he could very easily shift to another. In the meantime, he wanted something. As far as I can remember, it was a pocket handkerchief out of his portmanteau, which had been placed by the porter on a very inadequate trestle or stool against the wall at the furthest end of the room from his bed. Here was a curious thing. The portmanteau was not to be seen. Well, doubtless it had been moved by officious servants. Whatever it was that he wanted, it was not so necessary to his comfort that he could not wait until the morning for it, and he therefore settled not to ring the bell and disturb the servants. He went to the window, the right-hand window it was, and looked out on the quiet street. There was a tall building opposite, with large spaces of dead wall. The light was behind him, and he could see his own shadow clearly cast on the wall opposite. Also, the shadow of the bearded man in number 11 on the left, who passed to and fro in shirt sleeves once or twice. Also, the shadow of the occupant of number 13 on the right. Now, this might be more interesting. Number 13 was, like himself, leaning on his elbows on the windowsill, looking out into the street. He seemed to be a tall, thin man. Or was it by any chance a woman? Now came a distant step in the street, and its approach seemed to recall number 13 to a sense of his exposed position, for very swiftly and suddenly he swept aside from the window and his light went out. Anderson, who'd been smoking a cigarette, laid the end of it on the windowsill and went to bed. Next morning, he was awakened by the maid. He roused himself and, after thinking out the correct Danish words, said as distinctly as he could, "You must not move my portmanteau. Where is it?" As is not uncommon, the maid laughed and went away without making any distinct answer. Anderson, rather irritated, sat up in bed, intending to call her back. But he remained sitting up, staring straight in front of him. There was his portmanteau, on its trestle, exactly where he'd seen the porter put it when he first arrived. The daylight showed more than the portmanteau. it let the true proportions of the room with its three windows appear, and satisfied its tenant that his choice, after all, had not been a bad one. When he was almost dressed, he walked to the middle one of the three windows to look out at the weather. Another shock awaited him. Strangely unobservant he must have been last night. He could have sworn 10 times over that he'd been smoking at the right-hand window the last thing before he went to bed. And here was his cigarette end on the sill of the middle window. He started to go down to breakfast. Rather late, but number 13 was later. Here were his boots still outside the door, a gentleman's boots. Ah, so the number 13 was a man, not a woman. And just then he caught sight of the number on the door. It was 14. He thought he must have passed number 13 without noticing it. Three stupid mistakes in 12 hours were too much for a methodical, accurate-minded man, so he turned back to make sure. The next number to 14 was number 12, his own room. There was no number 13 at all. After some minutes devoted to a careful consideration of everything he'd had to eat and drink during the last 24 hours, Anderson decided to give the question up. If his eyes or his brain were giving way, he would have plenty of opportunities for ascertaining that fact. If not, then he was evidently being treated to a very interesting experience. In either case, the development of events would certainly be worth watching. During the day, he continued his examination of the Episcopal correspondence, which I've already summarized. To his disappointment, it was incomplete. Only one other letter could be found which referred to the affair of the bishop's tenant, whose name, he discovered, had been Magister Nicholas Franken. The letter was from the bishop to the Protestant leader, at that time Rasmus Nielsen. The bishop had written, "We are not in the least degree inclined to assent to your judgment concerning our court. Yet forasmuch as our trusty and well-beloved Magister Nicholas Franken, against whom you've dared to allege certain false and malicious charges, hath been suddenly removed from among us, it is apparent that the question for this time falls." Search as he might, Anderson could find no sequel to this letter, nor any clue to the removal of Franken referred to by the bishop. He could only suppose that the man had died suddenly. At supper that night, Anderson found himself next to the landlord. Why, in most of the hotels one visits in this country, is the number 13 left out of the list of rooms? He said. I see you've none here. The landlord seemed amused.
To think that you should have noticed a thing like that. Oh, I've thought about it myself once or twice, to tell the truth, but an educated man, I've said, has no business with these superstitious notions. But you see, in a place like this, the commercial class, the travellers, are what we have to provide for in general, and put them in number 13, why, they'd as soon sleep in the street, or sooner. No, as far as I'm concerned myself, it wouldn't make a penny difference to me what the number of my room was, and so I've often said to them, but they stick to it, that it brings them bad luck.
Then, what do you use your number 13 for? Said Anderson, conscious as he said the words of a curious anxiety, quite disproportionate to the importance of the question.
My number 13? What? I tell you, there's no such thing in the house.
Well, yes, only I happened to... I fancied last night that I'd seen a door numbered 13 in the passage. Of course, Herr Christensen laughed this notion to scorn, as Anderson had expected, and emphasized that no number 13 existed or had existed before him in that hotel. Anderson was in some ways relieved by his certainty, but still puzzled, and he began to think that the best way to make sure whether he had indeed been subject to any illusion or not was to invite the landlord to his room to smoke a cigar later on in the evening. Some photographs of English towns which he had with him formed a sufficiently good excuse. Herr Christensen was flattered by the invitation and most willingly accepted it. At about 10 o'clock, he was to make his appearance. But before that, Anderson had some letters to write and retired for the purpose of writing them. He almost blushed to himself at confessing it, but he could not deny that he was becoming quite nervous about the question of the existence of number 13, so much so that he approached his room by way of number 11, so that he might not be obliged to pass the door, or the place where the door ought to be. He looked quickly and suspiciously about the room when he entered it. But there was nothing beyond that indefinable air of being smaller than usual to warrant any misgivings. With a certain effort, he dismissed the thought of number 13 from his mind and sat down to his writing. When he had finished his letters, he ordered in whiskey and soda. And then he went to the window and studied the dead wall opposite and the shadows upon it. As far as he could remember, number 14 had been occupied by a lawyer, a staid man. Apparently, however, he was in the habit of giving vent to his animal spirits when alone. Why else should he be dancing? The shadow from the next room evidently showed that he was. Again and again, his thin form crossed the window, his arms waved, and a gaunt leg was kicked up with surprising agility. He seemed to be barefooted, and the floor must be well laid, for no sound betrayed his movements. After a few minutes, the landlord knocked at the door. To judge from his look of surprise when he found himself in the room, Herr Christensen was struck, as Anderson had been, by something unusual in its aspect. But he made no remark. Anderson's photographs interested him mightily, and it's not quite clear how the conversation could have been diverted into the desired channel of number 13, had not the lawyer, at this moment, begun to sing. It was a high, thin voice that they heard, and it seemed dry, as if from long disuse. It went sailing up to a surprising height and was carried down with a despairing moan as of a winter wind in a hollow chimney. It was a really horrible sound, and Anderson felt that if he'd been alone, he would have fled for refuge. The landlord sat open-mouthed. I don't understand it, he said at last, wiping his forehead. It's dreadful. Just then came an impatient knock at the door, and the person who was knocking entered without waiting to be asked. It was the lawyer, half-undressed, tousle-haired, and very angry. I beg pardon, sir, he said, but I'd be much obliged if you'd kindly... Here he stopped, for it was evident that neither of the persons before him was responsible for the disturbance. And after a moment's lull, it swelled forth again, more wildly than before. But what in the name of heaven does it mean? Said the lawyer. Where is it? Who is it? Surely, Herr Jensen, it comes from your room next door, said Anderson.
No, sir,
said Herr Jensen. Suddenly, the singing voice in the next room died away, and the singer was heard to laugh to himself, softly, mirthlessly. Then there was silence. The three men shivered. Anderson was the first to speak. We must do something, the three of us. Shall we go and investigate? The only weapons of defense that could be mustered on the spot were a stick and an umbrella. The expedition went out into the passage. There was a deadly quiet outside, but a light shone from under the next door. Anderson and Jensen approached it. The latter turned the handle and gave a sudden, vigorous push. No use. The door stood fast. Herr Christensen, said Jensen, will you go and fetch the strongest servant you have in the place? The landlord nodded and hurried off, glad to be away from the scene of action. It is number 13, you see, said Anderson. Yes, there's your door, and there's mine, said Jensen. My room has three windows in the daytime, said Anderson. By George, so's mine, said the lawyer. His back was now to the door. In that moment, the door opened, and an arm came out and clawed at his shoulder. It was clad in ragged, yellowish linen, and the bare skin, where it could be seen, had long grey hair upon it. Anderson was just in time to pull Jensen out of its reach with a cry of disgust and fright when the door shut again. And a low laugh was heard. At that instant, the landlord and two able-bodied men arrived on the scene. "You stay out here with the light, landlord," said Anderson. "One of you two men, break in the door and don't go in when it gives way." The men nodded, and the younger stepped forward, raised his crowbar, and dealt a tremendous blow on the upper panel. The result was not in the least what any of them anticipated. There was no cracking or rending of wood, only a dull sound, as if a solid wall had been struck. The man dropped the crowbar with a shout and began rubbing his elbow. His cry drew their eyes upon him for a moment. Then Anderson looked at the door again. It was gone. The plaster wall of the passage stared him in the face, with a considerable gash in it where the crowbar had struck it. Number 13 had passed out of existence. For a brief space, they stood perfectly still, gazing at the blank wall. An early cock in the yard beneath was heard to crow, and as Anderson glanced in the direction of the sound, he saw through the window at the end of the long passage that the eastern sky was paling to the dawn. In the morning, the same party reassembled in number 12. The furniture was cleared away, and at the cost of a good many irretrievably damaged planks, that portion of the floor was taken up which lay nearest to number 14. You will naturally suppose that a skeleton, say that of Magister Nicholas Franken, was discovered. That was not so. What they did find, lying between the beams which supported the flooring, was a small copper box. In it was a neatly folded vellum document with about 20 lines of writing. Both Anderson and Jensen, who proved to be something of a paleographer, were much excited by this discovery, which promised to afford the key to these extraordinary phenomena. But in the event, it meant nothing to either of them. Jensen hazarded the conjecture that the language, though similar to Latin or Old Danish, was in fact neither. Anderson ventured upon no surmises and was very willing to surrender the box and the parchment to the Historical Society of Viborg to be placed in their museum. I had the whole story from him a few months later as we sat in a wood near Uppsala after a visit to the library there, where we, or rather I, had laughed over the contract by which Daniel Saltenius, in later life professor of Hebrew at Königsberg, sold himself to Satan. Anderson was not really amused. "Young idiot," he said, meaning Saltenius, who was only an undergraduate when he committed that indiscretion. How did he know what company he was courting? And that same afternoon, he told me the story I've just told you.